As I say, we've written over the last 3 years two reports, and we're just finishing a third about press self-regulation. But I've been asked this morning to talk specifically about accountability in the UK press. And I thought that rather than talking about accountability in the abstract, it might be better to refer to a practical example. And this is actually rather a live practical example. But I think it's particularly useful because it's an example of multiple failures in accountability mechanisms in the UK press. It's also useful because it demonstrates continuing unaccountability, even despite the Leveson inquiry, and shows that in some areas, particularly because of the nature of the law and regulation, there may never be direct accountability, particularly for things like personal information and data mining. The example is the Motorman files and their aftermath, and I'll try and talk a bit about the story, but particularly about the aftermath and the repercussions of it. I had got illustrations online, but there's not a facility to show them, so I shall have to just speak. This is a live issue because the files are still officially secret. Some organisations and some people, including, I should say, the Hacked Off campaign, continue to make the case that they should be published in suitably redacted form. And depending on what you hear this morning, you too may want to make the case for their exposure. To give full disclosure, I haven't seen the Motorman files myself, but I have spoken at length to those who have. And I should say that many people now have seen the files within the inquiry, lawyers connected to the inquiry, and, of course, the newspapers themselves. But the story starts, I'm afraid, a little while back. It starts back in 2003 in a house in Hampshire, a house owned by a man called Steve Whittemore, who is sort of a private investigator, but sort of rather a lot more than that. And in March 2003, the Information Commissioner's Office raided his house. And in his office, they found a large quantity of papers related to work that he had done on behalf mainly of newspapers, but other organizations as well. But in particular, they found a number of books. They found, rather usefully, colored books. They found a blue book, which was cases that he had done for News International. They found a red book, which was cases that he had done for Trinity Mirror Group, and they found a green and yellow book, which was cases that he'd mainly done for the Mail Group and the Express Group with their sister publications. In total, there were over 17,500 transactions in the books, almost entirely from national newspapers and magazines. The senior investigating officer was a man called Alex Owens, and he and his colleague Pollitt took the evidence that they had collected to the head of the ICA, the Information Commissioner, and his assistant, Francis Aldhouse, to discuss who they ought to prosecute. And at this point, according to Alex Owens in his evidence to the Leveson inquiry, Francis Aldhouse, with a shocked look on his face, said, "We can't take on the press. They're too big for us." Owens and his colleague, Pollitt, were told not to make contact with any newspapers or interview any journalists. They were told they should focus on Whittemore and his specific network of moles. The way it worked, I should explain, was that Whittemore was sort of at the centre of a web, and he had various people in the police, in the DVLA, in phone companies, who, through various different means, would gather information on his behalf. And the way it would work is, let's say, to give an example, a journalist was standing outside a party in London, and someone came out, a celebrity, a public figure, got into the car and drove off. And they took down the license plate of the car, and they could contact Whittemore and say, "I need a conversion." And what a conversion would mean is that you take the number plate, he'd contact his guy at the DVLA, they would convert the number plate into a home address, a telephone number, and then from that they could therefore go further and dig more information out. And that more information often was friends and family numbers, ex-directory numbers, and then it went on to criminal records and other things as well. So the decision to investigate the press, Richard Thomas decided at that point, having got this information, Richard Thomas was the Information Commissioner at the time, that he'd pass all responsibility for press accountability on to the Press Complaints Commission. So he wrote in November 2003, he wrote to the then chair, Christopher Mayer, and said, here, I've got all this stuff. I think it's probably your responsibility to do something about it. Alex Owens, Thomas, in his words, was disappointed by the response of the Press Complaints Commission and wrote to them again and met with Mayer in 2003 and 2004. Bear in mind that there was evidence of industrial-scale information gathering by national news outlets across the board, certainly not just News International. And the PCC essentially ignored it. It did nothing at all publicly in 2003 and 2004, and eventually in 2005, under pressure, it released an advisory note on the provisions of the Data Protection Act. Now, the note didn't suggest that there was any evidence of malpractice. It didn't refer to any specific concerns about phone hacking or blagging. The note was for informational purposes only, and most of it was to do with journalistic exemptions. As it states, the Data Protection Act carries with it a journalistic exemption, an implicit reference to the media codes, including the PCC's code of practice. As such, the Commission is, from time to time, asked questions about how it is applied. Therefore, the Commission has drawn together some of the questions it's most frequently asked, and then had a list of basically FAQs about the DPA, the Data Protection Act. The passing on of responsibility from the Information Commissioner's Office did not end there. They also passed the information they had about accessing the police national computer to the police, who were at the time investigating leaks of police information through a separate operation called Operation Glade. Now, Operation Glade did lead to some prosecutions. Operation Glade led to the prosecution of Steve Whittemore and three associates at Blackfriars Court in April 2005. And they were convicted of conspiracy to commit misconduct in public office for offences involving the use of the police computer. But they were given conditional discharges. And according to Richard Thomas from the ICO, the ICO was then advised by its counsel not to pursue any further legal action. They took this advice, and they took no further legal action. But the following year, in 2006, we're not sure exactly what prompted this, but they did publish two reports. One, the first, called What Price Privacy, and the second called What Price Privacy Now. The first one describes Operation Motorman and the trade in the very lucrative and very large trade in personal information. And the second, slightly more controversially, published a league table of offending newspapers and the number of transactions that they had employed Steve Whittemore to do. The numbers actually turned out to be incorrect and a gross underestimate much, much later. So now it was in the public domain. Now that this report had been published, admittedly with very little detail, but it was in the public domain. And certain newspapers had, if you like, been named and shamed on a league table. You might have thought that responsibility, in terms of accountability, passed on to those news groups themselves to investigate and to hold themselves accountable. So what did they do? The Daily Mail. The Daily Mail was number one on the league table with, according to the Information Commissioner's Office, 952 transactions. It turns out that actually that was over 1,700 transactions, not 952. So not only did the Mail not investigate, it continued to use Steve Whittemore beyond his arrest, beyond the charges, beyond the prosecutions, even beyond the publication of What Price Privacy and What Price Privacy Now. According to the evidence of its lawyer, Liz Hartley, to the Leveson Inquiry, it used him up to 2007. The Express Group, the Daily and Sunday Express, were numbers 12 and 14 on the league table, did not investigate, did not sanction, continued using Steve Whittemore himself, and this is not other investigators, but Steve Whittemore himself, until 2010, according to their lawyer, Nicole Patterson, the Leveson Inquiry. Trinity Mirror, the Daily Mirror was number 3 on the league table. The People was very high up, as were other Trinity Mirror outlets. The editors and senior executives of the Mirror did meet in 2007, we've learned through the Leveson Inquiry. And they decided, in the words of its chief executive, Sly Bailey, to take what she called a forward-looking approach. This was not, she told the Leveson Inquiry, an amnesty, but a decision not to look back, which seems like rather a curious semantic distinction which is lost on me. Although so forward-looking was the Mirror in its approach that it only banned the use of private investigators in July 2007. In other words, no investigation, no accountability. Indeed, I think one could justifiably argue that there was rather a lot of willful blindness amongst many non-News Corp news organisations. Not content with ignoring some of the past evidence of malpractice, some news groups were already lobbying hard to prevent themselves from being held accountable for similar action in the future. In the summer of 2007, Les Hinton from News International, Murdoch McLennan from the Telegraph Group, and Paul Dacre had dinner with the then Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. In addition to arguing with him about conditional fee agreements, another aspect of accountability that I should leave for a separate debate, they pressed him hard to stop the increased sanction for breach of Section 55 of the Data Protection Act. The Prime Minister was, they said, very sympathetic and went so far as to broker meetings with Jack Straw and his officials. Two of them then met with Jack Straw along with Rebecca Brooks. We don't know, but we think that she failed to tell him that she is one of the names that we now learn is in one of those Whittemore books as commissioning him. And the news groups got their way. The sanctions were not extended. So therefore, effective immunity from prosecution remained, not just for newspapers, for insurance companies, for banks, and for many others that were breaching the Data Protection Act on a regular basis. And, as I say, the Express kept using Whittemore, Trinity Mirror kept using whoever they liked until July 2010, and the Mail, well, who knows about what the Mail did or didn't do. But after 2007, the ICO turned its attention away from the press, and Motorman was essentially forgotten for pretty much the next 4 years, although parts of the press continued to campaign against other legal restraints that they believed hampered their ability to report on people's private lives, notably conditional fee agreements and the so-called backdoor privacy law based on Article 8 of the Human Rights Act. And then in July 2007, The Guardian published its revelations about Millie Dowler and subsequently about bereaved families from Iraq and Afghanistan and victims of 7/7 bombing and others who had been hacked. And the Leveson Inquiry was set up, whose terms of reference include to inquire into the extent to which the current policy and regulatory framework has failed, including in relation to data protection. In late July 2011, having done nothing about the Mail's use of Whittemore and possibly other private detectives since 2003, the Mail suddenly sent four people up to Cheshire to go through the evidence that the ICO held on them in the Yellow Book. This was not prompted by the phone hacking revelations or by the establishment of the Mail Inquiry, the Mail told the Leveson Inquiry. It was a pure coincidence. I think this rather strains credibility. But apart from the timing, there was something else rather strange about the visit. One of the four people to go to the ICO was John Wellington, the managing editor of the Mail on Sunday. This is the same John Wellington who was the manager of the Mail on Sunday in 2004, when, according to the paper's editor, Peter Wright, it was discovered that he was overseeing payments to Whittemore, hidden amongst the travel expenses. At the very least, it seems highly inappropriate that Wellington was sent. At the worst, there cannot but be an impression that the person who had originally overseen commissions to Whittemore was checking if there was anything incriminating in the files. The Mail subsequently denied it had done anything illegal. The Mirror also took some action after July 2011 by asking one of its board members to do a report, the Vickers Report. It was not an investigation, again, but 44 senior editorial executives from Trinity Mirror were asked to give confirmation that they nor their staff had hacked phones, hacked emails, or accessed the police national computer. The Express, as far as we know, certainly publicly, took no action. And then we had the evidence of Alex Ernst, Richard Thomas, Christopher Graham, and Francis Aldhouse at the Leveson Inquiry. So why is this a good illustration of the lack of accountability in the press? Well, clearly no authorities were keen to hold the press to account. The Information Commissioner's Office wasn't. The PCC certainly wasn't. The police weren't, or at least certainly weren't, following the conditional discharge of Steve Whittemore and his colleagues. When the information was passed on to the press, some members of the press ignored the authorities, they ignored the reports, they did not investigate themselves, and they certainly never disciplined. And worse, when they were invited to investigate and potentially discipline, they sent, or in the case of the Mail, they sent someone who had originally been involved in the original commissioning. No news groups or journalists have been examined in detail on this until Leveson itself, and even now have only been asked in general terms. The only editor who was asked in any detail about it was Peter Wright from the Mail on Sunday, who was the one who revealed the information about John Wellington. Some of these journalists, I understand, are now in senior positions, and certainly that was from the evidence of Guido Fawkes apparent in the case of one journalist. So why open all this up now, and why raise it in discussion again? Well, for a start, I think to look at this and to look at it in detail, it's incredibly useful evidence to understand the issues of accountability in the press. And there's a very direct comparison, I think, here between the Motorman files and the MP's expenses. When MP's expenses were talked about in the abstract, they caused quite a lot of public discussion and quite a lot of public angst. But when the details of the MP's expenses came out, the whole debate changed utterly, and it became a cause célèbre, and it led to really rather significant change. I think it's very, very difficult to talk about some of the transgressions in the Data Protection Act and talk about these books endlessly in the abstract without looking at the detail. Secondly, because for the Leveson Inquiry itself, there's no need to tiptoe around prosecutions. In the case of phone hacking, they've been extremely careful not to prejudice any of the prosecutions of the individuals before they are potentially charged and prosecuted in court. In this case, there aren't, nor do I think, should there be any prosecutions, but the detail is incredibly helpful in order to ask people the question, was what you were doing in the public interest or not? And as we know, as Leveson has said on multiple occasions, much of what his brief is about is coming down to what is and what is not in the public interest. And here is 17,500 examples of what may or may not be in the public interest. And as I've said, there is a public interest defence in the DPA, so why not have that argument? One of the people, incidentally, who Guido Fawkes was the only person who has exposed some of this by publishing the Blue Book, which is the News International book, on Google Docs, which you can go online and see if you'd like, in some redacted form. The News International was actually one of the lesser users of Whittemore because they had access to other detectives like Mulcair and others. So there were about 1,000 transactions from News International. But, for example, one of the people in the in that is the then Sunday Times journalist Ian Cobain, who I'm sure was doing journalism in the public interest and should be given an opportunity to explain what it was in, why it was in the public interest, and to distinguish it from an awful lot of the claims that are in there from the News of the World and from journalists who have now been arrested or otherwise, who might find it more difficult to explain whether or not theirs was in the public interest. Why also? Partly because actually these files might also hold part of the key to how phone hacking happened. Alex Owens, in his evidence to the Leveson Inquiry, said he had a light bulb moment when he saw the list of victims in phone hacking, because many of them overlapped with many of the names that he'd seen in the Motorman files. And of course, one of the big things about the Motorman files in Whittemore was he was collecting ex-directory numbers, mobile numbers, friends and family numbers, and Owens said, hang on a second, hire Whittemore, get phone numbers, hack numbers. There's a rationale there. So in order to understand phone hacking, understand how it happened and how it worked, it might be very helpful to go through some of these files. Two other reasons why it would be extremely helpful to get these out, one of which is most of the victims, the vast majority of the victims from that were in the Motorman files have still not been notified that they were victims. So most of them don't even know that they're in the Motorman files. The ICO has said that it does not have the resources to notify the victims. Now, as I said earlier, we know that the inquiry team, we know that the inquiry lawyers, we know that the newspapers themselves, and we know that various other individuals have all been given access to these files and to these books. So therefore, there are an awful lot of people who know this personal information about these individuals, except the individuals themselves, which at the very least seems unjust. And certainly in the case of phone hacking, the judicial review found that the police ought to have notified the victims. And then finally, and I suppose one of the most relevant things to this today's debate and today's discussion, is that effectively where we are now is that the practical immunity remains. So in other words, when at the Leveson Inquiry, Christopher Graham, the current Information Commissioner, stood up, he said that the sanction currently for breach of Section 55 of the Data Protection Act runs at about, if you get a successful prosecution, runs at about £100. So in other words, the reasons, the rationale for any authorities, the ICO, the police, or anyone, to pursue a long and arduous prosecutions for the sake of £100 is pretty pointless. So there continues to be effective immunity for many of these breaches. And as we, I don't know who anyone saw dispatches on Monday night, but it was a program called Watching the Detectives, which was demonstrating that there is still an extremely broad and lucrative trade in personal information. It was not about the press, it was about detectives. But he showed both how easy it was to access personal information and how the flourishing trade continues. In fact, I saw the program maker on Tuesday night, Chris Atkins, who said that anyone in this room could buy anyone else's medical records in this room for £300. Which seems to me as though it is not the problem is far from solved. Thank you very much.